Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Mark Rasso, a filmmaker whose first feature, Copenhagen, told a delicate, complicated love story about two people making a deeper connection than either of them had bargained for. His new film, Kodachrome, stars Jason Sudeikis, Ed Harris, and Elizabeth Olsen as three people trapped together on a road trip of discovery and emotions and stuff. It opens theatrically in the U.S. and drops on Netflix worldwide this Friday, April 20th, and it's pretty good. Mark chose the talented Mr. Ripley, Anthony Minghella's exquisitely calibrated adaptation of the 1955 novel by Patricia Highsmith, previously adapted by René Clément in 1960 as Purple Noon, about an opportunistic sociopath who contrives to live a life of privilege and finds himself unwilling to give it up. Fresh off the triumph of The English Patient, Minghella assembled a fantastic cast of 1999's brightest young things, Matt Damon, Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, Cate Blanchett, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and set them against one another against the gorgeous backdrop of the Mediterranean. It's a seductive film with a cold, cold heart, which is entirely the point. This is someone else's movie.
When you put forth this this idea, which is great, what you're doing, it's you know, you're starting with
endless possibilities.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
It's slowly narrowing down. I think this will be like 106. I think this is episode 169. So we're ruling
yeah,
stuff out.
There was a couple of things on there that I loved. You know, I think I know Children of Men was on there.
Yeah.
You've done that, and Fight Club, I think.
Yep. Yeah. Jim Gray did Fight Club. Eric Johnson did Children of Men. Two really good episodes. Actually.
Yeah. So you know those stuff, and so Talented Mr. Ripley. For me, it was more because I wanted to explore why I enjoyed the film so much.
Sure.
And I thought, it's kind of this film that, you know, it's not a film that people really talk about. It's not really probably on anyone's top, like, top lists of greatest films or favorite films on all time. I don't even think it's on my top 20, but it is a film that I've seen many times, and every time I enjoy it a lot. And I thought, what a better way to try to discover why than to discuss it. And I think it's worth seeing, and if people haven't seen it, hopefully this will bring it to them.
I mean, yeah, that is absolutely the goal of the show, to pull people towards things, you know, mm-hmm. like to advocate for films. And I'm really glad you picked this one, because it was one that, I mean, I have it, it's on the shelf, mm-hmm. it's yeah, as you say, it's not a top favorite, but it never really goes away mm-hmm. either. Minghella's stuff is so specific and so, you know, it's beautiful and compelling and alluring, and in this case, that's what the movie is about. It's about being drawn into something that you can't flee,
yeah,
interact with. So somehow this movie is at a remove in a weird way among his filmography, mm-hmm. although, you know, so many of his movies are complex in that way.
For sure. I mean, yeah, for me the thing is the, you know, the and other movies have done this, but it drew us to the sympathetic sociopath, basically.
Yeah, very much.
Before kind of Tony Soprano or Walter White in television, you know, I'm going into television, but other movies have, other shows and movies have done it much later and, you know, with a lot more time to explore this, but, you know, we care about this guy and he's, you know, a bunch of things.
Yeah.
He's complex, obviously, but he's a murderer. He kills three people in the movie, and you know, we're in a way pulling for him. And it's just this, and even Jude Law's character is kind of like this despicable person who you just kind of, he's so, you know, cool. you just love watching him. He's like, you know, he there's a line in the film. It's like when he's something like, when he's focused on you, it feels like you're the only person, you know, or the sun's shining on you, you're the only person in the world.
Yeah.
And you get that sense watching him, right? So I just thought, you know, it's entirely well acted all the way through. Some great supporting performances from the late Philip Seymour Hoffman and Cate Blanchett. And I just thought it was something worth exploring and definitely talking about.
Yeah, you know, it's a film that I don't revisit often enough, I guess, because I carry it so vividly in my head, I don't feel like I need to. But it's one of those movies that slips away really quickly, too. I mean, yeah. It wasn't until I took another look at it that I realized just, you know, how seductive the whole thing is. The world that we're presented with is glistening. And the first time I saw it, I thought it was really over the top with the sun glancing off the water and everything else. But then, of course, the whole point of it is that we have to be in Ripley's head and want what he wants, which is why we sympathize with him in the first place, even though he's not a person who necessarily deserves sympathy. Empathy, maybe, but not sympathy. And then, of course, casting Damon, who is... he's a good person. He's a great actor. And there's something inherently nice about him. It's that Midwestern thing.
Yeah.
But it's the same function here that it is in The Bourne Identity, where we have to believe that he is capable of these things. And in The Bourne Identity films, the whole point is that Jason Bourne is conflicted about it.
Mm-hmm.
And here, it's a skill set that he deploys whenever he has to.
Yeah.
And at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
The lying, the dissembling, the physical stuff, the violence. He's got a very similar toolkit, but he can't be seen to enjoy deploying it,
mm-hmm.
even though I think, you know, like, if he feels anything, he feels triumph.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of always waiting for a chance to do stuff.
Yeah.
And that's why
everything is so... And there's so... Yeah, there's so much... you know, there's so much... There's such a great nonverbal performance. I think some of the looks, the kind of reaction shots of when things are happening that are great, and really, like you said, allow that empathy. And there is one... Because I'm just thinking about exactly what you're saying, is we don't enjoy... We don't... you know, we don't see him enjoying it. And there's one moment, and like, spoiler... I guess we're allowed to go spoiler alert here, right?
At this point, it's presumed that people will watch the movie before listening this far.
So after he kind of is trying to dispose of Freddie Miles, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman's body, you see him kind of mock his voice, but it's shot in a way that's like, we don't see his face. It's kind of over his shoulder, back. We see the body. It's a lump. We don't really have the image of it. And he gets this little, it's this little moment of pleasure. And, you know, he copies a line that he had said earlier in the film in his voice, in Philip Seymour Hoffman's voice. And I just thought it was quite an interesting way to carry off what you were saying, is like, you know, even when he is enjoying it, the way that Minghella handled it was not letting us judge it too much.
Yeah.
In a sense, really, you know, playing it off his back, playing it so we can't see his face.
Yeah, there's a lot of, it's not quite God's eye view, but mm-hmm. but distance.
Yeah.
In the film, to make kind of a specimen out of him, almost.
Mm-hmm.
It's. I guess. How can I put this without sounding incredibly pompous? There's so much space allowed in the movie to imply judgment, mm-hmm. or to imply the study of the character, that this really is picking him apart until we see that there's nothing inside. But Minghella's genius is that we want to keep looking, even after it's clear that there's nothing to this person, mm-hmm. but emptiness. It's not that we need to... maybe part of it is that the audience needs to invest... We believe that we need to invest in somebody who's worthy of our investment. Like, why is this guy the star of the film?
Interesting, yeah.
But it's fascinating to me because the movie keeps saying, no, look, there's really nothing here. Like, he's not a good person. He's a terrible person, objectively awful. By the end of the movie, why are we still hoping there's no redemption in this story. But it's so fascinating to spend that much time with someone who has no redeeming qualities except that he looks like a movie star, and therefore we are supposed to pay attention to him.
Yeah.
It's really an interesting choice for Damon, too, to jump into that film, you know, like a year and a half after Good Will Hunting.
For sure. I think there was, you know... It's a weird... It's also like... I don't know if our reaction is some sort of class commentary as well. When you're seeing, like...
Sure, it's an underdog story from one angle.
Yeah, and, you know, and he's... We set him up as you know, the basement apartment in New York with, you know, struggling, two jobs. This guy who's chasing the American dream. You know, even the song that they sing when they go to the cellar, the Italian song, is like, I think it translates to like, I want to be an American, you know, it really has that American dream. And here's all these people who are basically second generation of the American dream. All these you know, privileged kind of, we call them privileged private school kids who are off in Europe.
Oh yeah, they're the future captains of industry.
Yeah, exactly. Spending all this money, and I guess, you know, setting Damon's character up against them. It's weird that we like suddenly are rooting for like the underdog, but I don't know. I just think that element is like subtly, maybe not so subtly, but impacts our kind of empathy towards him.
Yeah, well, it's in that I'm sure Ripley would tell himself he's playing a rigged game. Mm-hmm. Like he's fighting the best fight he can to get into this thing, when all he really wants is, I don't think that he wants privilege. I think he just wants everything.
Yeah.
He wants whatever's in front of him. And he works his way through people and becomes who they need him to be and all of that. But yeah, the fact that he doesn't seem to have any real motivation, mm-hmm. other than not to be found out. I mean, that's the only time he ever gets exercised or agitated, is when someone is about to expose him.
Yeah.
And, or even playfully threatening is enough to seal your death warrant if you hit the wrong joke.
For sure.
Because he really, you know, he doesn't discriminate. He's very focused. And this guy would be, that's the weird thing, right? Like, you get the feeling he would be successful in a job if he worked his way into an executive position somehow.
It's like, it's if they would have cast Christian Bale, it could have been a prequel to American Psycho.
Sure.
In some way.
Yeah. Or, you know, the other person I thought of was John Hamm as Don Draper, right?
Yes.
Who is, Draper at least is self-aware in a way that's tragic,
mm-hmm.
right? The whole reason I never really got into Mad Men was because two episodes in, it's like, oh, I get it. He can sell the perfect dream, but he can't enjoy it himself.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Fine. And not to take anything away from the actor's work, but the thesis is pretty simple. Ripley doesn't even have that.
Mm-hmm.
I think he can enjoy things, but I don't know that there's a tragedy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's not conscious of his failings.
No. No, I think the only kind of tragic element to the film for me was kind of the ending of the film when he gets away with it, or we think he gets away with it, and he's kind of found, you know, there's this whole kind of homosexual undertones to the film, and I don't think they're really undertones. I think it's quite clear, but.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's with this guy who kind of accepts him for who he is. The only kind of guy, and we have to kind of buy it a little bit, because we don't really know why he accepts him for who he is. But he, you know, he has to kill him, and I think it's the only time we see him crying. You know.
Yeah. I just assume he's mirroring.
Yeah.
You know, like that, the other person is crying, so I will cry.
I will cry too.
But it's credible.
Like, yeah.
You believe. You also are fully aware that in that moment he is destroying what could be happiness.
Yeah.
That he's choosing to reject
and
salvation.
And Minghella's last shot, because I just saw the film again yesterday, which I hadn't noticed until yesterday, he put the camera in a closet.
Yeah.
which is funny, you know, and then let the closet door shut. It's back in the closet, I guess. But,
yeah.
You know, it's quite, and with mirrors and, you know, there's the whole imagery.
Oh, that constant motif of,
yeah.
Of people being reflected into each other and themselves, mm-hmm. and being alone with yourself, which is, again, something I think Ripley never is. I don't think there is a self.
Mm-hmm.
But have you seen Purple Noon?
I have not, no.
Really fascinating, completely different treatment.
Yeah.
And it's clear, I mean, Minghella and I talked about it when he came through town at the time. He had seen it and was avoiding it. Like, he didn't want to, I think he said he'd seen it in his younger days.
Yeah.
And wasn't revisiting it intentionally, but also because he wanted to make a European film,
mm-hmm.
in a different manner. I think he makes the subtext text in a way that René Clément didn't, because mm-hmm. in, what, 62, you just couldn't. You could have a lot of shirtless Alain Delon, but you mm-hmm. couldn't really go any further. And, I mean, it's Purple Noon's a terrific movie, mm-hmm. but The Talented Mr. Ripley is definitely a film made 35 years later.
Yeah.
It's just, it's got the weight of things and the sense that the actors are also willing to go a little further and dig into it. Hoffman is definitely playing someone who is self-aware and queer in a way that maybe nobody else is willing to be in 1950s America, certainly in America, that maybe not in Europe, but like Freddie is, he's liberated by being in Europe in a way that nobody else is. And so he can enjoy the gossip, but he can also see people clearly in a way that no one else is prepared to do, which I think is why it freaks Ripley out so much in this version, that that he is seen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's, I mean, he's so great. He's so great in that film. The thing I have to say is, I mean, Phil Hoffman's great in everything he does, really. So we know that. But those scenes with him, like, and we know Damon's a great actor, but those scenes together, they hold their own. I mean, Damon completely holds his own, which is great to see. And there's so many great performances, but yeah, that one on where he kind of barges into his room on the piano and kind of sees him clearly and kind of points it out. And it's the second time in the film he points it out. It's really something.
Yeah, it's tense in a way that maybe it wouldn't be willing to be with other people. With I mean, I think Minghella is a sensitive enough filmmaker that he would have caught it with anybody, but yeah, Hoffman just doesn't hold it back. He just lets it out and pushes in a way that clearly that Damon can play off of, but also in a way that is uncomfortable for us.
Yeah.
We feel voyeuristic. I think it's one of the only times in the movie that you squirm for someone's safety.
For sure.
Because you just know this is the wrong decision.
Yeah.
Like, he thinks he's being very, very clever, and it's absolutely not the thing you do with this guy.
Yeah.
But everybody has that moment with Ripley. That's what's so great about Minghella, is that his treatment of it gives us the room to see, like, the scenes with Blanchett and Damon, the scenes with Paltrow and Damon, the scenes with Law and Damon. We watch him watch them, and Minghella's genius as a director, I think, is visually staging those scenes so that we can pay attention to both characters, but also be directed towards the responses we need to see.
Sure.
And everyone is oblivious of Ripley, and we aren't. So we just, you know, we know to watch him. By the time the scenes start, by the time the second act comes along and it starts, you know, his interactions start having consequences for people, we have learned that we have to watch him and see at what point he gauges threats and how he responds. It's like, it really is like watching an insect.
Yeah, it's interesting because that shot, that right after he kind of comes back from San Remo after he's killed Dickie, it's a shot of Gwyneth Paltrow's character Marge at her table, and it lingers for quite some time, and it's super voyeuristic, and we just kind of watch her, and you know, she gets a start, and right then, as you're saying, it's on. Now everything that happens is consequential. This reaction is consequential. When we see Marge again later in the film, it is really interesting, and the Marge character itself is kind of, you know, she should be the most sympathetic character in the film. I don't know if I quite feel that way, but she should be. She's the one who invites him in. She's friendliest at the start. She kind of is a part of this whole process. She's the one at the end who sees him for what he is and kind of understands the truth and is kind of written off as you know, the crazy jilted lover or whatever. And then, yeah, I don't know. It's just a fascinating movie that I've watched so many, like, I can watch over and over again and kind of ask questions on, and as a filmmaker, you're trying to figure out, you know, what is he doing? What has he done to make me feel this way? I think it's super important. I know.
Yeah.
You know, these are other people's, and I'll stick to other people's movies, but
oh, no, feel free.
There's an influence on, you know, my first film, Copenhagen. We were introduced to this very unlikable character at the beginning, and also my latest film, Kodachrome. Both characters are kind of unlikable at the beginning as well, and it's like, you know, how do you create that empathy? How do you create that sympathy for them?
Mm-hmm. And in this film's case, he becomes, I mean, we want to like him at the beginning, and he becomes less likable as it goes on, and we see exactly what he's capable of, and then, oh no, he's capable of worse. Oh no, still worse. He's the movie is named for him, and he's in every scene, and why am I not rooting for him more? Oh, that's right, because he's a monster. But it is, yeah, it's fascinating to reverse engineer that, to experience the film and then want to go back and figure out why mm-hmm. And how we're seduced. And I think it's because, you know, it's part of it is the viewpoint, part of it is the perspective that we're invited to share, but it curdles so quickly. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, 40 minutes in, you have no illusions about who this is. Mm-hmm. We know it's not going to get any better, and it's just a matter of watching what he does now. Mm-hmm. And that's fascinating because we're hooked. It's a great story. You know, Patricia Highsmith knew what she was doing when she created the character, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, Ripley's is, stretches out over many, many books, not just mm-hmm. the one. But there's some combination of empathy and encouragement and voyeurism that Minghella hits that you need to know what he's going to do next. And it's not, there's no illusion that it's going to be positive, that mm-hmm. it's like bad things are coming. He's a storm. Wherever he goes, people are going to get hurt or worse. And all right, well, we're in now. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm invested in this guy. Let's see how many people he destroys. Yeah.
I also think Damon brings a vulnerability. Like, I did see Ripley's Game, which mm-hmm. was the Malkovich
right, film. Yeah. So that was about, what, 2004? 2004.
Yeah, came for, which, you know, Malkovich's take, or the script's take, or however they chose to go in that film, was a lot more calculated in the sense of a lot more, you know, it completely playing chess the whole time.
Right.
Whereas
he's older, he's sort of figured yeah. himself out.
Yeah.
He knows what his strengths are.
Whereas I did feel like, you know, Damon's, like, especially the first murder, he's, the way he played it, you know, he's opening himself up, he's setting himself up to be sorry, I'm tired, I can't find the words.
Okay. I was going to say exposed.
Exposed, yeah.
Seen, understood.
Yeah, and, you know, he is, in a way, vulnerable, and he gets backlash for that, and his reaction is to commit the crime. And the second murder that we already discussed is the same thing. He's about to be exposed. It's about to, like, you know. So, you know, like, I know you can't say you sympathize with murderers, but in a way, once you spend this time, you're like, okay, I get it.
You know, kind of like, right?
He had to, like, what else could he have done? You know, and then you feel kind of feel bad for, you know, and you're like, why am I watching this? And
no, it tricks you into rationalizing with him. Like, by the time bad things happen, it's like, well, I mean, obviously, you just don't poke him. Yeah. You shouldn't do that. That's his fault. But of course, it's not.
It's the same thing with, like, The Sopranos. If you like The Sopranos, you know, you sympathize for this guy, and then every once in a while he's just a thug and he just does nasty stuff, and you kind of, you're reminded just a little bit. And I don't know. I like those kind of captivating, you know. There's a lot of films with very kind of altruistic characters, and you just like to have cheer for the bad guy every once in a while.
Yeah, it's true.
Or the complicated person.
You know? Yeah, and it's not... The Sopranos, I think, tried very hard to shock people with Tony's violence, which is weird because he is who he is and he was never going to change. But with this, there's no... Like, it's not a thriller in that way, is it? It's really just more like the air going out of a balloon very slowly for 2.25 hours. You're just like, oh, more. yeah. But, of course, right? Looking back, watching it again, it is pleasurable to just watch the mechanics of it mm-hmm. and see how these inevitabilities are just being put in front of you, and you kind of hope they don't turn out that way, but no, this isn't going to go well.
And I wonder, it almost had to take place in Italy too, or like the Mediterranean too, right? Just the allure of it, as you mentioned off the top, the allure of the lifestyle. Like, I mean, anyone would want to be spending their summers in that beautiful coast town.
I think that's a way of getting us as well on his side really early, because he's going on, you know, like, he couldn't afford it himself. He's going on someone else's dime by lying just right off the bat, by presenting a false version of himself. Oh, no, I'm successful. I know your son. Maybe I can help. And that thing the phrase, I don't think it's ever spoken in the film, but it's one that always hovers at the back of my mind when I think about it, is, that's mighty white of you.
Yeah.
Like, there was a point in time where just by looking like that, I mean, who am I kidding? It happens right now. It's half the Trump administration. But by looking a certain way and presenting yourself at the right moment to somebody, you could be of service and you buy your way in.
Mm-hmm.
And he fakes the buy-in, but he kind of does deliver. Like, he does everything he says he's going to do. He does find Dickie. He does deliver the father's message, and everything else goes to hell because he decides it will be easier to just be Dickie than it is to bring him home. But the way everything comes to him, the way everything flows so easily, speaks to this. I mean, privilege is the obvious word, but it is this level of ease that he has in the world even before the psychopathic code switching. Mm-hmm. Like, he could do just fine if he stayed the course, but he sees things and wants them, and that's if he has a tragic flaw, it is simply that he has no self-control, that he'll do whatever he wants to do, and that's what makes it tragic with women, that's what makes it tragic with Dickie, all these things he can't allow himself to express become the thing that makes him become his trigger. Right? It's that I think, you know, he would really like to kiss Dickie. I don't know that Dickie would like that back. Mm-hmm. And that motivates him to simply be a better version of Dickie, right? Like a version that he is happy with.
And it's actually interesting because this is why I like to talk about stuff. You know, in this kind of, you know, Damon goes into this period where he's playing both characters and he does it quite well and he kind of transforms into Dickie. And then when he's writing the suicide note, it's like, it's exactly what you're talking about. He's writing like everything that he wanted Dickie to, you know, he wanted Dickie to say to him. You're the brother I never had. You're this, you know, whatever. He kind of gets to express that. He gets to live that. He gets to feel that.
And to literally write a better history.
Yeah.
That makes him comfortable with the things he did, right? Because if Dickie does kill himself, then he's absolved.
Yeah.
And it serves a plot point, but I think what we see in the performance is the wish fulfillment too. Mm-hmm. Like his need to have this better story. I mean, he's
and then
gaslighting people all the time, but this version he's gaslighting himself.
And then he gets to go back to, you know, being him, but this version of himself that he, you know, that he kind of strived for at the beginning. So it's quite an interesting, you know, character arc that he's on.
Oh yeah.
the way he manipulated it.
Yeah, and you can understand how Tom Ripley as a literary character is so alluring, because to spend time with him in books where you don't actually have to see the horrors, where you don't have to confront them, I think it's harder to do him in film just because you have to be in the, you know, like we're on the boat with him with the bloody oar. Mm-hmm. There's no way around it. If we're going to spend time with him visually, you have to see it.
Yeah.
But in prose, it's more evocative. It's more, you can linger on different things. You can choose not to see as you read. And yeah, that's the stuff that Minghella is engaging with in his film, is that, no, this is a bad person. You have to watch him do these things.
For sure. But, I'm thinking of the scene right after he kills Jude Law's character, you know, they go to this bird's eye view shot and he's kind of, the boat's floating in the ocean and he's wrapped his arm around him, you know, and he's
trying to help,
you know, and it's just like he's getting this embrace that he's always wanted from this character, and it's a fleeting moment. Obviously he's got to go bury the body and get rid of it, or we don't know what he's going to do. He's got to figure the rest of his life out, but it's like, and I think it's just these little touches that Minghella does like that, that just really create that empathy despite all the kind of the harshness of it and the real kind of violence that's behind it all.
Yeah. And I forgot to ask you this up top. When did you first see it? Did you see it theatrically at the time?
I saw it theatrically. I was in university at the time, and I ducked out and went to go see it by myself. Jeez, there used to be theaters there. They're not there anymore. I forget what they were called.
Whereabouts?
Right on Bloor Street, like just north of the university.
Oh, the Cumberland.
The Cumberland, of course. Yeah. The Cumberland. I saw it at the Cumberland.
I saw it between the... I saw it in the Famous Players screening room between the university and the Cumberland, underground.
That's funny.
Right there in this dinky little 30-seat theater, which did no justice to the film at all.
Yeah.
I actually wasn't until I saw it a second time in a proper theater that I really got the sprawl of it.
Yeah. I saw it and I fell in love with it. I think I fell in love with Italy. I fell in love with the beauty and didn't come out on DVD for like a year and a half or something crazy. You know, it used to take a lot longer than it does now. And then I, you know, bought the DVD, watched it again. Just watched it every 3-4 years, I'd watch it again. Just captivated me and I hadn't seen it probably for, I don't know, 8-9 years since I watched it again recently yesterday. So some of the stuff was a little bit, you know, I still think it, I think also my progression as a filmmaker, I'm noticing stuff, like I didn't realize like how many zooms were in the film. Yeah. It was like instead of like tracking shots, everything was done with a zoom lens, and it was, you know, it threw me off a little bit because I felt like it didn't really fit the time period maybe or something. Yeah. I don't know.
That's interesting.
But yeah,
because in the 50s, things were pretty flat.
Yeah.
When I think of Italian cinema zooms, I think of like Bava and Argento, really fast, snappy ones. But it works for me in the way that it works for me in that scientific sort of way, that, mm-hmm. that we're looking at someone under a microscope, that it's just
I'm sure that was the intent, and it does work quite well. I just, you know, I had something
you hadn't remembered.
Exactly. And he definitely captures that kind of Dolce Vita feel, you know, in Italy, and it's there's a sense of, and I think I had just been to Italy for the first time a couple of years before the movie came out, and kind of fell in love with the country as well.
Right.
So, you know, I had these things going for me, but it was it was at that time. I saw a lot of good movies. I remember.
Oh, 99 was a good year.
Yeah.
There's another podcast actually called Podcast Like It's 1999.
Oh, cool.
That Philip Iskov and Kenny Niebart, I think, are going through all the movies. That is their assignment, is they're going to go through every film released, some 250-some movies that were released that year. And Ripley, they did fairly early on.
Okay.
And there's stuff in there that quarter, that the end of 99, we got Being John Malkovich, we got Fight Club in October, I think, mm-hmm. is the earliest one. And then, what else? Magnolia and Three Kings and there's one other major film, but everybody was delivering. It was all just big, serious art cinema.
Yeah.
And then 2000 and 2001, it sort of pulled back into commercial stuff, but there was this moment where, Anthony Mangello could follow The English Patient with this expensive art house movie about...
And that's the thing, is like, I don't know if this movie gets made in this way, you know?
Yeah.
With this ending and this kind of, the way it doesn't, it just kind of lingers. And, you know, I don't know if these movies get made today, or if this movie gets made at this budget today. I just don't know it.
Yeah. And with the cast that it had, I mean, everybody in it is major. Obviously everybody wanted to work with Miguel, I guess, but it's, you know, to say that, there's a movie with the biggest names, not just then, but now, because, mm-hmm. you know, Blanchett's only gotten bigger, and Hoffman, of course, didn't get to go further, but by then, like, he was coming off Boogie Nights, and he was already... And Happiness the year before that.
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Paltrow just won the Oscar. Yeah,
for Shakespeare in Love. Yeah, and Matt Damon, Good Will Hunting a few years earlier.
Yeah, and Jude Law was just ascendant in a way that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah,
he was suddenly everywhere. But, this was like the big, the surprise role for him, a small mm-hmm. character role in the middle of this larger film. Even though it is exactly the same part he played in Gattaca, which I think is intentional. Just cast him as the sacrifice.
I mean, it's interesting because you know, Damon, you're casting Damon as Ripley, and he has to envy Jude Law. And it's not like Damon is just like the average Joe, you know? Yeah, he's like a movie star in his own right. But it's like, then you put Jude Law in front of him, and you're like, it almost had to be this kind of like Adonis, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to think.
Beautiful man who's, you know, everyone wants to be, to make that dynamic work.
Yeah. I want to attribute this to Minghella. I don't know that I'm absolutely right. It might have been something I came up with, but I think he described it as you start with a quarterback and then you introduce him to a concert pianist. And it's just like, this person can do things you can't do, and you thought you were the best at what you are.
Yeah.
And maybe you are, but this guy is another level of person.
Yeah.
And it had to be, he said it, the life had to be so alluring that you want to understand why Ripley would risk everything.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he doesn't see it that way. He just sees the thing and wants it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Law is, he's great. He's weird. His physicality is mm-hmm. really precise. He's just carrying himself in a way that suggests freedom in a way that yeah. Ripley doesn't, because Ripley's really constricted.
And it's interesting. Again, a thing I noticed on this latest viewing is that there's a scene in the movie where an Italian woman drowns herself, and you see Jude Law's character, who's this kind of like above it all, kind of, you know, doesn't get into his emotions, keeps it all, like, just break down and lose it over it, and it creates this humanity to him that we don't see in Ripley ever in the film,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it would almost be nice, you know, I guess it wouldn't work if Ripley got there, but it's just a weird thing where, like, they're kind of in that moment, they're kind of inverse of each other, and Jude Law suddenly, you know, even his ability to go there is something that Tom envies in a way, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That he
you can't. Almost want to see him try.
Yeah.
But that would be the false note that gives him away.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so rich in its characterizations, and it has the room mm-hmm. to. We've barely even talked about Blanchett, and she's fantastic.
She's great.
Everybody in it is so good. And Paltrow, too, there was that point in the early 90s when she shows up in, she's in Malice and Flesh and Bone, mm-hmm. I think, in both films within the space of a few months, and you totally understand why people responded to her the way they did, why she was suddenly cast in everything, and why she was so sought after. She's got this amazing presence that she then spent 15 years repressing in a weird way. Like, becoming more serious meant giving away that spark.
Yeah.
But we see it here. Like, yeah. Angela got her to bring it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. And her, you know, in a way it's almost a similar role to, I mean, very different movies, but Seven, this kind of supporting, mm-hmm. you know.
The idealized.
And in both movies, she just does a great, you know, job of really capturing it.
Yeah.
Nailing.
She brings what could have been an underwritten role to life.
Yeah.
And Blanchett is doing something very different, which is she's being bigger and mm-hmm. brassier and almost vulgar.
Yeah.
But then we have Freddie to be truly vulgar. So it's just a great way of establishing the lines of where people are socially acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, Paltrow's character isn't from money like the other characters are. I don't think
it's... Or less, right?
Or less,
She's a less successful family.
Less successful because I remember the family, the father at the beginning was kind of not happy with the woman that he met there or something like that. Just a hint of it. And, you know, kind of the more human... Of all the supporting characters, the more human characters.
Mm-hmm.
The more vulnerable character.
Yeah, earthier, grounded.
Yeah, grounded for sure.
She seems more appreciative of the things that she has, mm-hmm. which is... different in every way from Dickie, who just, you know, he likes things, he takes things for granted, and then you get Tom, who just likes things and takes them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess Paltrow's performance kind of suggests that she knows she's going to have to go home eventually,
mm-hmm.
that this isn't, like, this isn't her life,
yeah.
she's on vacation. And then we see someone who just wants to be on vacation forever.
Yeah.
And she can't. She ultimately can't connect with that either.
Yeah. That's cool. And at the end when they take her, they have to literally be pulling her onto the boat. You know, it's this... That's good. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, I got to go back and watch... this thing I got the most is I got to go back and watch all these 90s movies that we just talked about and listen to this podcast. But
yeah, it's great. You should listen to it.
But, you know, it is a... I don't know... Really, and I'm a filmmaker, so it's part of my responsibility, but I wish they, you know, made movies like that again. The lines have changed. Maybe it's the amount. You said 257 movies. I mean, that's like a month these days,
yeah, it's
maybe.
Yeah, nothing anymore. It's also something you mentioned, like, how would you make it today? I think the mistake would be that someone would want to make it as a television series, that you would want to, you know, have the adventures of Tom Ripley to sort of... how can I put it? You would convince yourself that people like antiheroes, we should just follow him week to week, and that would be awful. It would just be terrible because he's like, Ripley's a guy who goes years without incident. Mm-hmm. He that's the whole point, that you can follow him over decades if you want to. And the idea that he would need to have adventures and constantly be coming up with things on the fly, that's not him. Like this, you need the space, you need the pacing, mm-hmm. you need the slowness. And that's where Minghella's greatest asset is that he's content to watch mm-hmm. behavior and let the actors fill the room. And you know, if every scene was a last second escape, as yeah. you know, he leaves the hotel just as the police get there, it would be exhausting, it would be frustrating, it would ultimately be unbelievable that mm-hmm. that the guy's that lucky.
Yeah.
And I'm also trying in the back of my mind to figure out who you would cast as a Tom Ripley character now, and I can't think of anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to see Channing Tatum do it, but he's too big. Like, he'd be too recognizable. You need somebody who was Damon in 99 Delon in Purple Noon is stunningly beautiful, mm-hmm. and it works for the stylized version of the film. But if Tom Ripley is memorable, he gets caught.
Yeah.
So, yeah, where do you go?
Interesting.
That was the sound of a police van slamming shut as Tom Ripley was escorted away.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I hope they don't remake it. I really hope they don't. Some things just need to to be what they are.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, if that isn't one of the strengths of the film. Because it's a period piece, it doesn't feel like a 90s movie in that way. The cast list is totally 90s, but there's something about it that sets it apart. It's the same way that, Three Kings commentary is set in 1990, but it could take place in the immediate present, and it still feels contemporary now, 20 years after. This one, set 30-odd years before, doesn't feel, or 40-odd years before, doesn't feel dated in the slightest.
No, it doesn't. No, really. I was really happy, because when I chose the movie, I was like, I'm going to go watch it now. You know, I've been getting into some of these 80s... these movies I loved as a child that just don't hold up the way you thought they did. Yeah. And I was like, oh, this one, it hasn't been that long, but I really hope it holds up. But it held up wonderfully. And
No, it's a good choice. It's one that, I mean, hopefully we can get people to go watch now. But it's one of those films that is so much better than I remember. Because there's more to discover, and you can just lose yourself in it. Mm-hmm. In a few scenes and just drift along with the characters, and that's something that Minghella always had. The English Patient feels a little more contrived now, because that sort of grand romantic filmmaking was already out of style when mm-hmm. he did it. But this one, just it's almost, if it wasn't for the beauty of it would be an almost kitchen sink depiction of the book. It's mm-hmm. just these things happen to these people in this place, and we are trapped with them, and it's gorgeous and everybody's very pretty, but there's nothing more complicated to it, so you can just plug into it at any time.
Yeah, and I do find it, I don't know how many times I've seen it now, but I do find I take, sign of a good movie, you get more out of it the more you watch it. Mm-hmm. The looks, a lot of Damon's performance stuff, looks here and there, in the bar, setting stuff up, musical choices, meanings of songs, stuff like that. It's very nuanced, and I think, I'm fascinated as a filmmaker by this this idea of, I guess it comes from advertising, but like the subliminal kind of messages, right? How do we get an audience to feel a certain way or think a certain way or react to something without being so overt and throwing it in their faces? And how do we subtly kind of do this? And I think this movie does it in there's a lot of like what you were talking about, the zoom lenses, being that feeling of being under the microscope. And I mean, you're obviously not a typical audience member, because you've seen
I spend a lot of time
watching movies, and so it's harder and harder, and rightfully so, more critical. But I think there's a lot in there that he does in a very subtle, which is what directors are supposed to do, but you don't always get it. To kind of guide us and help us, and started off by calling him the sympathetic sociopath. It's like, how do we do that? Well, this is how he did it. That was his job, and he completely nailed it, in my opinion.
Yeah, he's laying out a blueprint for everybody to go forward, and just it's interesting to see how few people really picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
And more often than not, they went with a more bombastic version, or an unsympathetic
mm-hmm.
protagonist, like, you know, next year's American Psycho, which, I mean, they'd already, Mary Harron had already made the film by the time this came out, but it's the opposite. As you say, like, if you cast Christian Bale in this film, it's a very, very different film.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think there is a lot to learn. There is a lot to learn from this film about that, you know, storytelling.
Yeah. So, is there anything to that end? Is there anything that you borrowed or used or absorbed and knitted into your own creative DNA?
You know, I think you kind of do this stuff by osmosis almost, you know. It's not like, but when I watch it, first time having seen it, the last time I saw it, I probably hadn't made my first feature film yet. So watching it after the fact, I can see this, you know, allowing moments, giving performers, actors moments of reflection on screen, moments for the audience to kind of to place their feelings on it, or, you know, get in the head, react as they would react. So there's so much of this film is just, as you mentioned earlier, just we're kind of on Tom, seeing what he sees and seeing him see it, being on his face, moments of silence. And I think that's one thing that I can see in my work that I'm now cutting into this. I don't know if that's working from,
right,
or other films, you know, there's certain films that I like to watch before I make a movie where, you know, that's similar in style. But I did notice that a lot, and I did think, oh, you know, and also my latest film, Kodachrome, you know, we try to deal with reflections. I would have wished I watched this movie as a reference beforehand, because there's many wonderful kind of visual reflections in it.
Oh, I was going to ask you if the scene where Harris takes his own picture in the mirror is a direct line, but now I'm thinking it's more about, you said this at the beginning of the episode, that the thing you do is introduce unlikable characters, mm-hmm, and make us like them, or make, mm-hmm, us see them.
Yeah.
And so is that it? Is the introduction of someone who is, you know, ambiguous to us, at least part, mm-hmm, of it, the sense of watching someone reveal themselves slowly. I mean, what we get in Ripley is someone revealing himself to have nothing inside.
Yeah.
And you're doing the opposite.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by that. I think, I don't know why. It's just, that's the journey I want to watch, right? I want to see someone deal with their shit and get over the hump and be able to move forward. You know, I always like to say, like, a film should be about the most important moment in someone's life, and like, let's that moment where they kind of, they're able to now go and live their life, you know, let's give that those days or weeks or years, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's, you know, I'm drawn to kind of taking these unlikable, or flawed, I won't call them unlikable, flawed characters, and let's watch them get over the hump. And hopefully, you know, you want to make an impression on people, you make films for an audience, so hopefully someone takes something from it and is able to, you know, it's always nice to be able to help someone do that in their lives as well.
Yeah. Ripley is not that kind of movie.
Ripley is pure enjoyment. But I think it's important as a filmmaker to kind of, you know, I mean, you're a film critic, and I don't know how you do it, because I think it's hard, you know, I think it's a very, very difficult job. But when I watch a movie, the first question I ask myself is, you know, did it give me pleasure to watch it or not?
You know? Yeah, sure.
And when it gives you pleasure, like this film did, the next question is, okay, why? Some of these movies, it's really easy to figure out, and you can go down that road. And some movies, it's a little bit more difficult. And the more you look into it, the more you kind of feel, and like this, like, why am I liking this movie about this sociopath, psychopath, if you want to call him that, you know? Mm-hmm. And you start to question it, and that's interesting. Those are the movies that are really interesting for me, that they do something to me that I can't really explain right off the bat.
Yeah. No, that's all anybody wants, right?
Yeah.
I mean, ideally, you should get that from art. You should be forced to interrogate yourself. Mm-hmm. There's that dumb meme about how, what is it, something that doesn't challenge you is entertainment, something that does challenge you is art. I don't know that that's necessarily true. I can be challenged by my entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I saw Rampage last night, and it's just fun.
Yeah.
Like, it's just big monsters punching each other and Dwayne Johnson running around under the monsters. And
yeah,
sometimes that's all you want. Yeah. It's well executed. It's fun. It's silly. It evaporated on the way home.
Yeah. Well, sometimes that's all you need, though.
Yeah. I 107 minutes of nothing with candy. That's fine. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that. But this, you know, we're talking about The Talented Mr. Ripley, and I want to watch it again right now. That's that's the compliment cool. there. Yeah. Cool. And I'm glad you brought it up.
Cool. Great.
My thanks to Mark Rosso, whose new film Kodachrome drops on Netflix worldwide this Friday, April 20th. It's also opening theatrically in a 10-city release in the U.S., Los Angeles, New York, that sort of thing. And you should check it out. Thanks also to Kevin MacLean. He knows what he did. You can find Mark on Twitter at Mark Rosso, all one word, and you can actually find his first feature, Copenhagen, on Netflix now as well. You can find The Talented Mr. Ripley on Blu-ray and DVD from Paramount Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. And go listen to podcasts like It's 1999. It's a lot of fun. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you do that sort of thing, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.